Hello and welcome to another catastrophic episode of Saved by the 90s. My name's Adam Patterson. With me today is a guy who never runs from danger, Ken Bakley. Hey, Ken.
Hello.
This month, we're exploring disasters, both natural and man-made, with reviews of four disaster movies released throughout the decades. So batten down the hatches and take shelter, because this is Saved by the 90s.
And now let's make that random call with today's $10,000 question. Who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel?
Hello?
Hello, for $10,000.
Oh, what?
Excuse me?
Hello, hold on, let me go for what? No!
Oh, I'm sorry, your time is up.
Gut milk.
Is that a milk ad?
Yeah. You're probably too young to remember the Got Milk ads.
I know the ad campaign generally. I don't know if I remember any specific ads. Yeah.
There's a reason I picked that one too. We'll get to it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because when you're playing these ads, I'm just hearing the audio on my end as well. So I spend the entire ad trying to guess what it's for if it's not immediately apparent. And that's just one of the ones where it just surprised me at the very end.
Yeah, some of them, yeah, I mean, just listening to them, some of them, I try to pick ones that sound okay, that you can, like, hear without necessarily being able to see it. But with this one, I was kind of specific in why I picked it.
Okay.
Which I'll get into.
Yeah. Kicking things off this month is the second film from director Jan de Bont after the wildly successful Speed was released 2 years earlier. Released on May 10th, 1996, this is Twister.
Nothing else in nature
is starting to turn.
Can match its raw power.
Get out of there!
Its brute force, its howling intensity,
come on!
Its uncontrollable fury. On May 10th,
it's coming!
The producers of Jurassic Park and the director of Speed bring you face to face with Twister. Rated PG-13. Starts Friday, May 10th.
The reason that I picked the milk ad is because the guy from the milk ad was in the movie Twister. He was one of the storm chasers. That's why I picked it.
Good choice.
Yeah. Bill and Joe Harding, advanced storm chasers on the brink of divorce, must join together to create an advanced weather alert system by putting themselves in the crosshairs of extremely violent tornadoes. All right, we'll start with you, Ken. What did you think of Twister?
So before we get into our review, I want to point out that two of the movies that we are going to discuss this month, well, at least two, I'll check the other ones, but the 90s were a time when the beloved Motion Picture Association of America introduced their descriptors for ratings, why a movie was rated, why it was rated. And it seems like in the very beginning, and I'm sure we've mentioned this many times on the show before, they really were trying to be as deeply descriptive as possible. And I mention this because Twister has perhaps one of the most infamous MPAA ratings, rated PG-13 for intense depiction of very bad weather. Now, as a small child, I was, like, I'd say well into, I don't know, until I was about 11 or 12 or so, I was very afraid of very bad weather. Just didn't like it. I just didn't like it. I thought only bad things could happen when the weather got very bad. Strangely enough, this did not coincide with an obsession over the movie Twister, whether positive or negative. I just didn't think about it. I knew it was around, but I just didn't think about it. So my point is, it's a movie that I had always known about, like, it had always existed, and I'd say I've probably seen the last 20 minutes of it, like, the end with the big tornado at the end, quite a lot, just because it's just that, you know, big kind of, like, disaster movie set piece. But I don't really have strong feelings about this movie, and I haven't even seen it from start to finish all that many times. So I rewatched it for the podcast, and I'm here to declare that I think it is okay.
Okay.
That's my build-up.
fizzled out there a little bit.
I was a touch anticlimactic.
I can understand why someone coming to this movie for the first time now would be a little bit meh over it, because I mean, I've seen this movie, I don't even know how many times I've seen this movie. My wife really loves this movie, so anytime it happens to be on, she's watching it. And my dad really loves this movie too. My dad is like this huge disaster movie buff for whatever reason. That's like his guilty pleasure is disaster movies. He loves them. So this was one that like I grew up with Twister. I think I had a Twister poster at one point.
It's a great poster.
Yeah. So this was I had it on VHS. This was like one of our like family movies that we watched a lot of the movie Twister. So this was kind of a classic, at least in my family, in my household, this was a classic. So that being said, I can understand coming to it fresh without having that like level of nostalgia, not growing up with it, and just kind of being like, oh, well, you know, it's okay. It's an okay disaster movie. But, you know, revisiting it now, this is like a movie that's been like so ingrained in my brain that I don't need to revisit Twister. Like, it's not one of these ones where it's like, man, I haven't seen The Crow since I was a kid. I really want to go back and see if it holds up. Like, I know exactly how Twister holds up. And that's like, you know, to me, it still holds up. However, I can understand, as I said, where people would just come not be very impressed with it.
I almost want to kind of finesse my point now, because I'm not coming to it fresh. Like, on the other hand, like, it's hard to describe my relationship to this movie, because my relationship to this movie is encompassed in two aspects. First one is, I own it on Blu-ray, but I've only mainly used the Blu-ray to watch the last half an hour of it, just because it's very good to watch in high definition. And the second part of the movie I know is of course, the part that everybody knows with the cow. So those two things are seared in my brain. Like, when I was rewatching this, which is maybe the second or third time, I'd say that I've actually seen it from start to finish my whole life. As soon as it gets to a point, actually maybe before the 30 minutes, like everything on the drive-in scene forward, it's almost like I kind of have it just memorized. Like, I don't need, like, I almost felt like I didn't need to rewatch it, because I actually did rewatch the whole movie last year. But that part, it just, like, it's like you react to it like you were doing something with muscle memory for me. So I don't even know. Like, it's maybe my kind of mixed feelings on it maybe stem from the fact that I do have such a fragmented relationship towards this movie, where there are parts of it that I know really well and other parts of it that I don't know so well. And so coming back to just those parts that I know, it's just like, it's like coming home again. It's like, I just know this. But then it's the other parts, and it's just a less familiar, like, broadly competent 90s action disaster movie, where it just collides in my head in this really weird way, and I don't really know how to adequately describe my feelings about it.
Yeah, I think that looking at Twister, like, just critically, there's not a lot going on. I mean, it's pretty much nonstop action when you look at this movie. Like, there's not a whole lot of plot going on. The entirety of the movie is basically spent from beginning to end with them literally just chasing the storms and being in the storms.
Yeah.
Like, there's not that much build up. There's not that much downtime in between the Twister scenes, the tornado scenes. So, you know, if you're not into the perilous weather, then there's not going to be a lot for you here. I think that the characters are fun. You know, I like movies that involve like a crew of people, and I think that, you know, the characters in this are good. Like, you have Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton in the lead roles, but then you also have a lot of really great, you know, a really robust supporting cast with, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman is like this crazy, his name's Dustin Davis. And he's like,
such a good performance.
He's like the comedic relief guy. He's like the wild man. He's the wild card of the bunch. And then you have all these other really great supporting characters as well. You have Cary Elwes in the sort of villain role, which is funny that this movie has like a villain in it, like a bad guy.
The movie does not need a villain.
Yeah, we don't. I don't
at
know.
At least a human villain.
Yeah, we don't really need an antagonist. I mean, we have like the tornadoes. Like those are sort of the ultimate antagonists, right? I'm not sure that we necessarily need Cary Elwes and his like his crew that they don't care about the science. They just care about the money. They just want the money.
Yeah, it's such a character and arc that feels like a like seventh team of writers the studio handed to doing a rewrite kind of addition.
It's just so bizarre. Like, why can't you care about? I mean, the money, like getting the corporate sponsors allows them to get the advanced equipment. You know, so it's like, I don't know. Watching it now, like when I was a kid. It was so obvious that those were the bad guys because, you know, they had the all black, the vans were all black and stuff. And they were so clearly supposed to be the bad guys. But watching it now, I'm just like, what's so bad about it? Like, I don't see it in the same way, I guess.
Another thing that, yeah, I think the more we talk about this movie, the more strange it is that I just have this indescribable reaction to it because it really isn't like, I mean, we'll talk about a movie where if you just want to put on a fragment of a movie just to like see how it plays on a high definition television, we'll get to that. But yeah, you're right. It's this movie is kind of just a admirably competent and technically proficient movie, and on like a structural level, it really is, with the occasional 5-minute interlude thrown in, more or less just nonstop tornadoes. I'm almost wondering, is it like, do I just need to like invert my entire like understanding going in of my relationship to this movie altogether? Because it's just gotten to a place that's so convoluted and based on like jagged memories of it that I don't have many terrible things of use to say. So I will, however, continue by saying this is one of those movies that's just a staple on cable TV, and I often find that when I'm channel surfing and I come across this movie, it is an unusually high number of times I will land on the cow scene.
Well, yeah, that's sort of the classic scene, I guess.
I don't know why I am I don't know why, because it's like I don't know that it's on. I'll just see it on and then I'll go there, and it seems like multiple times I have landed on that scene.
That's the most famous scene. I will say that, like, I think most of the effects work really does hold up. I think that it still looks really, really good. And I think that maybe is part of a broader topic that we can discuss with all of the movies that we're going to be talking about, in that, you know, these movies were sort of the last fragments of film before things started getting really CG heavy. And, you know, these movies, they're all done on very elaborate sets using almost all practical effects. You know, you have some CG here and there, obviously the cows and stuff like that. But, you know, these movies, all the ones we're going to be talking about, are done for the most part practically. And they look great. Like, I think that most of them do hold up. And I think the Twister still looks really good to this day, and I think that's mostly just due to the fact that, you know, they had wind machines and rain machines and all this, you know, were doing these crazy weather effects and stuff. You know, they were running trucks through houses, and even though it may be impractical, it still looks cool.
It is. Oh yeah, it's maybe when I say that I'm more drawn to towards the end of the movie, maybe I'm specifically also drawn towards them driving through the house.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ridiculous stuff that happens in this movie, but the thing is, like, it also doesn't take itself entirely too seriously either. Like, it has fun with it. It tries to, I think, be at least kind of scientifically accurate. I mean, this is written by Michael Crichton. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's at least somewhat based in science, but at the same time, it does like to play fast and loose with physics and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sorry, that truck would just never go through that house.
Absolutely not.
It just wouldn't happen. Then again, this is the same director that did Speed 2 Cruise Control, where we saw a boat or a ship essentially go through an entire city. Just wouldn't stop.
I feel like now we need to take any excuse we can to actually talk about the first Speed.
Yeah.
On this podcast, we need to actually talk about that now. Because the order we've gone in for Jan de Bont's 90s output is now Speed 2 to Twister to, I guess, Speed 1, if we ever get there. We started on Speed 2.
Yeah. And we did Speed. We did Speed 1.
Did we?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm almost certain. Wait, now.
I thought we talked about
Now Speed I'm second 1 guessing it because. Yeah, now I'm second guessing it because now I'm thinking that did we talk about Speed 1 when we were reviewing Speed 2?
I think I kind of remember us talking a lot about Speed 1 just because we wanted to delay having to talk about Speed 2.
Maybe, because I remember I definitely watched Speed 1 in preparation for the show, but I can't remember if it was like...
Yeah. Now that you say that, I do remember it was in our Speed 2 discussion, and you talked about how you rewatched Speed 1 and you were worried that was a bad decision because it was just going to because it's such a good movie and Speed 2 is such a not good movie that would just kind of make the comparison worse.
Yeah, I think that was what happened. I think I ended up just watching anyway, at any rate. It's
Speed 1, good movie.
Speed 1 is a good movie, and I think that it's definitely Jan de Bont's best, without a doubt.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think I think that maybe one of the things about Twister is that it's like it's a movie that has become so saturated, like it's just everywhere all the time. Like it's one of those movies that like everybody just knows about and probably everybody has seen at some point, at least most parts of it, just because I think that it has become a classic, and I think that it is one of those movies where if you grew up with it, it's just kind of hard to say like, oh man, I really love that movie, because it's just always there.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that's kind of getting in the way of my opinion on it, is just that it's that combination of my very convoluted relationship with it, plus the just the nature of it becoming the kind of movie where I'm not sure if I think about it, I'm thinking about the movie or I'm thinking about the movie as it's saturated into the culture.
Yeah. Yeah, it's understandable.
So I'm going to say, watch, for anyone who it's not seen Twister, it's been a while since I've seen it, I was going to say, no matter what, watch it again.
Yeah, I think it's still a really fun movie, regardless. I think it's still... If you're, like, one of the three people in the world who hasn't seen Twister, I would say, check it out. It's worth a look. It's a fun disaster movie. And, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed looking at the Twisters, sucking stuff up, sucking up the cows and the, you know, tractors and stuff like that. Yeah, it's a good time.
Have you heard the story, who knows if it's true, where
the theater
I read somewhere? No, I know there is so much Twister lore about like tornadoes hitting where it's playing. I was thinking about something else, the marketing of Twister, where allegedly they wanted to do kind of like a too heavy 90s tagline. They wanted to make the tagline "It sucks," but they didn't go with that because that would just be like too easy an ammunition for like negative reviews of it.
Yeah, I didn't hear that one, but there is an urban legend about a drive-in theater, I think in Canada, maybe, that an actual tornado hit the drive-in during the scene when the tornado hit the drive-in in the movie. But I don't know if that's true, if that's an urban legend.
I think it's probably... I think I've heard something where it was like a drive-in that was playing it, but it wasn't playing it at that time, at that exact moment. But yeah, no, it's still crazy that it would happen. I think it's just one of those stories where By the time it gets around and everyone ends up hearing about it, there's just everyone just adds a little piece onto it, and so then it becomes a tornado hit a drive-in. Not only during a screening of Twist, not only
during that
while
time.
Twist was there, not only during a screening of it, during that exact scene.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's fun. It's fun.
It's a good story. Yeah. I'm not gonna like. It's a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Any final thoughts about Twister before we move on?
I learned I don't know how to talk about this movie at all.
I mean, what is there to say about it? You know, like the effects hold up. It's kind of it's a pretty fun movie. It's cheesy at times. It's really light on plot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
everybody go rewatch Twister.
It was sad watching it because Philip Seymour Hoffman passed away and Bill Paxton passed away and
that's rough.
Michael Crichton passed away and I don't know, probably like 5 to 10 other people in that movie passed away, and it's just, so there is kind of a bittersweet moment, I think. All right, next up, we have a movie that I saw in the theater when I was in 7th grade, and it was the first movie I saw alone with my friends. We all hated the movie, but had a memorable experience regardless. Released on February 7th, 1997. This is Dante's Peak.
This Friday.
Did anybody feel that?
Go with the flow. Dante's Peak will rock your socks off.
This is not good. This is not good.
A thrilling blockbuster adventure.
Stop!
With mind-blowing special effects.
Get out of there now before it's too late.
We do not think you have enough time.
Heart-pounding, run for your life thrills.
Come on!
It will blow you away. Dante's Peak, rated PG-13, starts tomorrow at theaters everywhere.
Go with the flow.
It'll blow you away. It'll blow your socks off.
And the Twister people were afraid to go with it sucks.
Yeah.
A volcanologist arrives at a countryside town recently named the second most desirable place to live in America. I'll add the caveat. It was second most desirable place under 20,000 people. And discovers that the long dormant volcano, Dante's Peak, may wake up at any moment. However long that synopsis has been online, I should add that caveat because it's a it's important that you get that small piece of exposition exactly right.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Dante's Peak. Adam, so you don't like this movie?
Nah, I never liked this movie. I mean, when I saw it in the theater in 7th grade, I didn't like it then. I think that I might have watched it maybe one other time or saw parts of it one other time since then, and I didn't like it. And then I rewatched it for this show, and I still think it's a bad movie. I just think it's straight up a bad movie. I think that it's funny. I think that there are a lot of unintentionally funny moments to this movie, specifically the boat scene with Grandma in the jumping in the acid water. Like there's a lot of funny moments, but none of them are intentional, and I think that it's a fairly poorly made movie.
I've got a story about that. I've never seen this movie from start to finish before. When I was little, I did see like about a small segment of the movie on TV. Channel surfing just completely skewing my perceptions of every movie. At a very relatively young age, the scene that I flipped on was that scene. I was like, "What is this?" And then I went away and didn't come back to that.
Yeah, that scene I think is probably the most memorable scene. Like when they're in this, just to set the stage here. There's the volcano is about to erupt, or like it's starting to erupt, and Pierce Brosnan is trying to save Linda Hamilton and her kids and her. I don't know if it's wait is it I don't I can't remember if it's her mom or yeah. The grandma, and they have to get across this lake, so they're in this rowboat, or it's not even a rowboat, it's like a little motorboat. For some reason it doesn't have oars in it. I've never seen a boat that didn't have oars in it, like whether it had a motor or not, like the boat always has oars. So not sure what that was all about, but at any rate, the lake has turned acidic from the volcano, and as a result, it like burns up the motor. So they're basically stuck on this lake that has boiling acid water. And first of all, they start singing "Row, Row Your Boat," which is utterly ridiculous. In that scene.
A choice.
Yeah. The other thing is when the boat starts to sink, someone, I can't even remember who it was, but someone goes, "Acid eats metal." And I was just like, okay, acid eats metal. No, duh. And then, of course, Grandma ends up getting into the water and pushing the boat, the like 10 feet or whatever to the shore. And then she succumbs to her injuries. It's ridiculous. The whole movie's ridiculous. Now,
yeah, we salute her sacrifice. All I knew as a child, I guess at a quite impressionable age, was just like, I did not come down here to watch television and see this melting grandmother. And now when I go back to it, I'm like, I don't understand the point of that entire scene at all.
Yeah, it's. The whole movie is just so silly. Like, just everything about it. It's like, the way that it's structured, it's sort of like Jaws, where you have this quaint little town, and because they were named the second most desirable place under 20,000 in America, there's, like, all these new opportunities that are supposedly coming to the town. Like, the tourism and all of this stuff, and more money flowing into the town. But, you know, Pierce Brosnan, who is this volcanologist, he's like, hey, you know, this peak is about to erupt. You guys are going to be in trouble. And everybody ignores him, of course. And then you have his boss, played by Paul Dreyfus, who, anytime I see Paul Dreyfus, I just think about The Thing. Like, I can't not think about his head ripping off and, like, the tentacle legs coming out of it. He's here saying, like, there's no issue here. There's no problem, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, the volcano erupts. The thing about the grandma, coming back to her, is that her name's Ruth, played by Elizabeth Hoffman. She doesn't leave her house. She's just like, nah, I'm not going to leave. And they're like, there's a volcano erupting. Nah, I'm not going to leave. Like, there's a volcano erupting, lady. What are you doing? Like, why would you just not leave your house? All she was saying was, like, to leave the house and go into town. It's not like, you know, she's asking you to fly to France or something.
Yeah. Wasn't there someone when Mount St. Helens erupted, there was, like, some guy who, like, ran something near the mountain, and he kind of became this weird folk hero in the media, if my understanding of what I've read is correct, because he refused to evacuate, and he was like, here's this guy, he won't do what people tell him to do, he won't evacuate because the volcano is going to erupt, and he died.
Yeah,
I mean, like, this guy, and it's like, I don't know.
I couldn't help
the story that you're trying to teach there.
I couldn't help but draw parallels in this movie to what was happening with COVID and how everybody in the town was in complete denial of the whole thing. All of the people were like, it's nothing to worry about. Don't worry about it. And then when they finally do say, you got to get out of here, people are like, nah. It's just, I don't know. I guess for the last year, I've been drawing parallels with every piece of media with COVID anyway, so.
It's especially hard not to do when we're watching movies about large-scale disasters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, of course, there's this, like, really lame love story between Pierce Brosnan and Linda Hamilton that comes up, and, like, Pierce Brosnan in this is such a sleazebag. There's, like, this one scene where they start to kind of make out, and she says something about, like, how she hasn't been with a man in a long time, and he goes, it's like riding a bicycle, and I'm just like, oh, God, come on. Why is he... He's just so sleazy in this, but
yeah.
I don't know. I will say that I think the effects in this movie also hold up for the most part. There's some kind of rough looking blue screen work in this. Some, like, kind of, I guess would be like compositing that's happening. But other than that, I think that the effects hold up. Some pretty impressive effects, which is funny though, because like when I was a kid and I saw this, like I remember not being impressed with the effects, which is like, I think that that just goes to show you, like, I feel like we've gone backwards with impressive effects, special effects in movies, where I'm a kid and I can see Dante's Peak and I'm like, yeah, you know, it looked fine. You know, like it was nothing mind blowing. But then when I watch it now and I'm in my 30s, I'm like, whoa, they blew up that house for real. Like those bridges, those bridges looked like they were really collapsing and those cars were getting all crunched up. Because now we're so used to everything being done on a green screen, like everything's done on a soundstage with a green screen and everything is fake. And it's just, sure, they've come a long way, but I mean, I feel like just doing it for real is you're never going to beat that.
Yeah. It's like, no, yeah, I will watch one of these movies, and if I see, like, an actual, like, palpable practical effect like that, or, like, driving through the house in Twister, I'll, like, want to stop and watch it again, because, like, I need to save for this, because no movie that's coming out now is going to give me anything that looks remotely like this.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really crazy stuff that happens in this. Like, when he's driving the truck, and the whole truck is on fire, and, like, the wheels are on fire and stuff, like, that looked wild. There's some really crazy special effects in this movie, and it's like just stuff we don't see anymore, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
other than that, I think the movie's dog crap. I think that I'm not sure why Linda Hamilton didn't have like a huge career. Like she had a good career, don't get me wrong, but I just feel like she was just at the top of her game during this, and I just don't know why she wasn't like in everything.
Yeah, it's
every time I see an actress in a movie like during this time, like the mid 90s, and I wonder like, oh, why haven't I seen more of her? I just assume that it was a Weinstein thing. Like I just assume that person got blacklisted.
I mean, yeah, that was going to be the answer I was going to give you, is just Hollywood. It has been and continues to be just absolutely awful to women.
Yeah, it sucks. Anyway, what did you think of Dante's Peak? Did you like it?
No, it was not very good. I wanted to watch this because this was not one that I had seen from start to finish. Otherwise, I was going to have to, like, if we're going to fill out our disaster movie lineup for the month, if one of the other options would have been Volcano, but
yeah.
I've already seen Volcano, and I wanted one movie that I hadn't seen before, just for putting together this lineup before I suggested it to you, and yeah, I don't know, I kind of fell into the thing of, well, which we'll talk about some more, comparing two very similar disaster movies released around the same time with Armageddon and Deep Impact, but Volcano and Dante's Peak is sort of an interesting question. I kind of got into, after I watched it, reading like geologists assessing the two movies, and the consensus is Dante's Peak kind of wins by default, I think, just because it makes some effort towards factuality, whereas Volcano doesn't. What was interesting is from some of the things that I read was that a few geologists took issue with the movie presenting like Pierce Brosnan's behavior as heroic in terms of like sounding the alarm as early as he did, because they really didn't feel like contextually in the movie he had enough to like want to call in like the to start thinking about, I don't know, evacuating the town or something. And in terms of response, apparently the general procedure through which actual like with the actual authorities and would be recommended to respond would be kind of in the way that the villain of this movie does.
Well, that's the thing, like, so they set it up like that Pierce Brosnan is the voice of reason, like he's the one who knows what's going on here, nobody's listening to him, and then there's that big I told you so moment when it starts to erupt. But the thing is, his whole team is like, dude, there is no evidence that this thing is going to erupt. It was all based on a hunch. Like, there was nothing for him to be like, this is going to blow. Like, there was nothing other than, like, he was just like, I think it's going to. There's no evidence.
He walked into the town thinking that it's going to erupt.
Yeah, like, he went in knowing, like, I'm going to get these people out of here. Like, regardless, this thing's going to go. So, it's weird. It's weird that they did it that way. You would think that, I don't know, they would have, like, at least one of the readings. Because, like, a big part of this movie is him just going around taking readings, taking the drone, that robot thing in, looking at the temperatures, the seismographs, all that different stuff. You'd think that they would have, like, at least one, just one of those readings be, like, elevated or just not normal, just something to grasp onto. But no, like, everything is completely normal in this, and then but Pierce Brosnan's losing his marbles over it. It's very strange.
I mean, obviously then you have to figure out, like, the flip side would be just, I don't know, a movie where he spends the entire time freaking out and nothing happens.
I kind of would like to see that, where Pierce Brosnan just, you gotta get the town out of here, and like 3 years later the volcano's still dormant.
Yeah.
Of course, Paul Dreyfus, the boss, who is like the voice of reason behind everything, is the one who ends up getting killed. Because he's, I don't know what his deal was. He was driving, like, why didn't he get out? Like, he saw that that little bridge was going, but whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I will say that other than, I was impressed with the effects. Like, that is one thing that I will say I have a larger appreciation for today, but the movie itself, I think, is still crap.
I can't argue with that.
It's just not good. I liked Volcano a lot more, actually.
Oh, I should have mentioned it then when I was talking about it, because I just gave you these four, and it was like, here's the four that I'm thinking, let's do disaster movies, because Twister and Deep Impact came out in May. And that was it. That was my completely arbitrary reason for choosing this, is because I thought, I wanted to.
No, that's fine. I wanted to revisit, because I still remember chunks of Volcano, and that one, I don't know, I didn't really have too many memories tied to that one. I saw it on pay-per-view at my grandma's house. But, like, yeah, with this one, I actually have, like, a specific memory tied to it, and the fact that I saw it in the theater and my friends and I all hated it, and I don't know, and I haven't really seen it since then, so I was kind of curious to go back and rewatch it and see if I still felt the same way, and it turns out I do. So there you have it. That's Dante's Peak.
Volcano, great tagline. It's hotter than hell.
Yeah.
Good tagline. Does Dante's Peak even have a tagline? Probably not.
Probably not. Who cares? It was fun, though. Like, it was fun to laugh at and make fun of.
I feel like we've now talked about this movie in more detail than anyone has talked about it in about 24 years.
Oh, yeah.
But Monica, I love you!
Romance on the rocks, Brad?
Lori?
Why don't you tell us what happened?
Nothing. I dialed zero to call a collect.
And what should you have done?
Dialed 1-800-COLLECT and saved us some cash?
Would have been my move. Want to try again?
1-800-COLLECT. Yo, Chuck, do you mind?
Our next feature is the first of two movies released in 1998 about a giant space rock colliding with Earth, but this one doesn't feature a hit Aerosmith song. Released on May 8th and directed by Mimi Leader, this is Deep Impact.
The government will try to hide it.
Turn your camera off.
The military will try to destroy it.
Prepare to synchronize the nukes.
But on May 8th...
We're at T-minus 3 minutes and counting.
The whole world will feel the comet's impact.
They're
from executive producer Steven Spielberg.
You're gonna die if you stay here.
If you love me, you'll go.
And director Mimi Leder.
Life will go on.
Deep Impact.
We will prevail.
Rated PG-13. Starts Friday, May 8th, everywhere.
A comet is discovered to be on a collision course with Earth. As doomsday nears, the human race prepares for the worst. Alright. Ken, what'd you think of Deep Impact?
On many levels, this is an objectively better movie than Aerosmith, but it's so much less fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, this is another one that I do own on Blu-ray, and another movie that I kind of just had just when I want to take a brief spin of how movies can look and sound good on Blu-ray. So it's another one. I've seen the last 20 minutes of this movie more times than I could possibly count. I have seen the preceding hour and 40 minutes of it, I think, maybe twice now, including this time.
Yeah, I saw this movie in the theater. My dad really liked this movie. I don't think I saw it since it was in the theater. Like, since I saw it in the theater. I remember not being super impressed with it back when I saw it. I remember I liked it, but I just remember being like, it's fine, I guess. Nothing crazy. And that's, I guess, sort of how I feel about it still. So, yeah, I actually don't really have too much to say about Deep Impact. I think it feels super long. It's 2 hours, but it feels really long to me. I don't know why.
I think it's just that there's so many like interweaving storylines in it.
I think so. And I think that you could probably say the same thing about most disaster movies where you have, you know, an ensemble and you have multiple storylines that are happening at once. And typically disaster movies are just generally longer than most movies to begin with. So I don't know. It felt very long to me. And some of it I thought was not great. But for the most part, I mean, it was cheesy, but it was still fine. Like, I had a pretty good time with it, I guess.
Yeah, it's, again, I mean, contrasting this with Twister, it's interesting to watch a disaster movie where the disaster is relegated to the last 20 minutes in its entirety, which I think is a choice that works. I'm not saying that it's a bad, it's part of how the movie's designed, and it's reasonably well thought out along those lines.
I kind of forgot about that, actually. Like, I you know, when you think of Deep Impact, you just think of that final sequence. But I think that it's easy to forget that most of the movie is them trying to prevent this from happening.
And I think what's interesting is it's a movie about a series of failed attempts to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just that, like, because it doesn't really fit into the rhythm of how a movie like this would operate until the very end, when it ends with sort of a courageous sacrifice on behalf of humanity. But from the end, it's just kind of like people sitting in rooms and realizing that the thing that they've come up with to make up for the last failure has also failed.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're not familiar with Deep Impact, it's two comets. One is smaller. I don't even remember the sizes of them now. I think that the big one was like the size of Manhattan or something, but they got rid of the little one, was it? I can't even remember now.
One of them hits, and then the other one are able to explode.
Yeah, so the goal was to, it was the same as Armageddon, where they take a space crew to it. Now, in Armageddon, we're dealing with an asteroid here, and Deep Impact is a comet. Now, I probably should have looked up the difference between the two, because I think I probably used to know that from back when I was in school, but I can't remember what the difference is.
Wikipedia informs us that comets are distinguished from asteroids by the presence of an extended gravitationally unbound atmosphere surrounding their central nucleus.
Oh, of course. So, yeah, the goal was the same. They were going to take a crew to the rock and blow it up. But what happens in Deep Impact is they go to the big one and they blew off a chunk of it, basically, and it didn't work. So they end up, the smaller one does hit, and it's pretty catastrophic. And the big one, if it hit, it would kill everybody, basically. And the crew decides that they're gonna sacrifice themselves, and because they have some extra warheads on the ship, and they decide to kamikaze into the big one and blow it up. Pretty big cast here. Yeah. Taya Leone is, I think she was like the most memorable person in it. She was sort of the main character. She plays a reporter for MSNBC. And she was really the only person that I remembered in this. And Morgan Freeman, of course. Morgan Freeman plays the president.
Yeah, I'm shocked going back to it, the amount of time it devotes to the Elijah Wood, Lily Sobieski storyline. I literally don't remember it.
I forgot all about that. So you have Elijah Wood and Lily Sobieski as students who... Elijah Wood's character, Leo Biederman, he's the one who actually discovers the comet, which is crazy, by the way. Like, that this kid would discover this comet and no one else would see it. And not only that, but, like, there was a large span of time between when he, like, wrote the letter and did all that and sent it to the astronomer guy. And so... like, the amount of time that passed for them to, like, not know that this thing was... I don't know. It's just hard to believe that that was the case. But anyway...
Yeah, the movie begins with all this information being sent to an astronomer, Dr. Wolf, who puts it all on a floppy disk and is going to tell the... whomever he's supposed to tell about it, but he dies in a car crash on the way there, which still doesn't kind of fill in the gaps of the question of, like, exactly how the information then got to the people it needed to get to in that absence, because it seems like the floppy disk probably didn't survive that.
Oh, I highly, highly doubt it, considering it was one of those deals where it was like he was driving the car and it went over a cliff and the whole car just instantly exploded and got completely vaporized. And not only that, but they thought that two people were in there. They thought that Biederman was another astronomer who was in the car with him. So that must mean that the car was so vaporized that they thought there were two bodies in there that just got turned to ash. So yes, so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, really.
The only other thing I know, I think about when I think about that first scene, besides the ridiculous car crash, is I told you this when I was rewatching it yesterday, all of the extremely great late 90s computers going on in that scene.
Oh, yeah. There's
the floppy disk. I love the big, bulky mechanical keyboard with all the audible, you know, clicking when he's typing in the... Yep.
There's some good 90s tech in all the movies that we talked about this month. Like in Twister, how they have that giant chunky beige laptop that they carry around. That thing is incredible too. And I think it was I can't remember if it was the last movie that we're going to talk about, but somebody was using zip disks a lot, and I can't remember which movie it was, but I remember taking note of them utilizing zip disks. I think it probably was the next movie we talk about.
I think so too.
Anyway, you have John Favreau in here, as one of the astronauts. He doesn't have much to do, though, and he gets killed pretty early. Like, as soon as they get out into space, he gets killed. Mm-hmm. Or as soon as they land on the comet, pretty much.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a fine movie, I guess. I think comparing this to Armageddon, which, obviously, you're going to compare the two. Armageddon was the more successful, I imagine. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm just going to go ahead and say that in my recollection, Armageddon was a far more like a popular movie. But I actually like Deep Impact more than Armageddon.
It's a better made movie. If I'm going to rewatch one, I'm going to I'm going to think in my mind that the obvious choice is Armageddon with Aerosmith and space dementia.
I don't know if I will rewatch either one of them ever again. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. I mean, we already covered Armageddon on the show, so I just don't feel like I ever have a reason to rewatch either of them again. Because honestly, I'm not the hugest fan of either one, but you know, it's
No, me neither.
As far as disaster movies go, it's fine.
Yeah, I really admire the attempts made in this movie. I don't know if they succeed, but the kind of overall vision and vibe and feeling of this movie, I do really like. It does feel kind of unlike other movies that we're going to talk about, or especially unlike anything you would try to make now from this idea on this budget.
Right. And I think that it's also, of the four movies, I think it is the most conventional of disaster movie. Like, when you look at other big bombastic disaster movies, it follows the same sort of formula as Deep Impact. And I think that, you know, there were a lot of disaster movies that preceded it that, you know, it, I think, certainly borrowed ideas from and just structural concepts with, like, having the large ensemble cast and, you know, multiple things happening, and then, like, the big crescendo at the end where you have the giant set pieces with the huge disaster moments. So I think that as far as, like, the four movies that we're discussing, I think this is the most conventional of the bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Mimi Leader, I'm not super familiar with her stuff. She did The Peacemaker before Deep Impact. That was the one with George Clooney and Nicole Kidman. I don't know if I've ever seen that movie. I very vaguely remember it, but I don't think that I actually saw that movie. And after Deep Impact, she did Pay It Forward, which I definitely did not see. I remember when that came out, I thought that it looked so dumb and lame, and I was at an age where a movie like that just would not, that would just completely go past me, and definitely wouldn't consider watching a movie like that. Mm-hmm. She did a lot of TV stuff since then.
It looks like most of her credits here are TV.
Mm-hmm. She did that movie On the Basis of Sex, which was the Ruth Bader Ginsburg biopic with Felicity Jones.
I remember when it came out, though.
I didn't see that either.
I remember it. I don't remember seeing it.
Yeah, I remember it coming out. I didn't see it either.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it was also that thing where, also that year, there was the documentary about her, which I did see.
I did see the documentary also.
Yeah, I feel like this almost pivots into what we're talking about movies with very similar subject matter coming out so close together, which is, if that's actually happening now, I just completely forget which one is which. Even when one of them is a fictional, but the other one's a documentary. I don't know. There was a half second where I was like, which one of them did I see again? And I was the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like she's on mostly TV. I think I think the directing here is very solid. The cinematography, I think it looks really interesting. Like, it's almost a shame because since the only part of this movie I've seen many times is the big, very CGI-driven disaster at the end, the movie itself that precedes it is pretty interestingly shot. The cinematographer was German cinematographer Dietrich Lohmann, who actually died shortly after production wrapped on this movie before it came out. I think the movie looks really interesting, or just kind of very... It's just visually a lot warmer than you would expect this movie to be from the end of it, the kind of the big set pieces that form the most famous parts of the movie. I actually found a lot to be impressed by the part, the bulk of it that I don't really have any connection to. This is not to say the movie's very good in totality, but I was interested by actually watching it.
Yeah.
As one instead of just going back and looking at basically scenes for reference points.
I agree. I think that a lot of it, the scenes that are like sort of the build up scenes, it almost plays out like a political thriller or something.
Yeah.
Where you have Taya Leone as this journalist who's trying to make her way, she's trying to get her big break, and she's like investigating this like tip that she gets and trying to figure out. You know, she thinks it's an affair with James Cromwell, but it turns out that it's, you know, that's a giant comet that's careening towards Earth. I liked all that stuff. I thought that was actually quite interesting.
I had no idea that James Cromwell was in this movie for literally 45 seconds.
Yeah. All right, so that's Deep Impact. Yeah, I don't know. Light recommend, I guess.
I'd say it's interesting to watch. There is more going on in it than I would have ever guessed just coming back to it, but it's not great.
Yeah, I bet a lot of people who saw this, you know, years ago forgot that like the large portion of the movie is not the Earth being destroyed. But a lot of people forgot about that.
No. which is weird because for me going back and looking at those scenes, just kind of just looking at them as like a piece of like technical filmmaking or you know, the big CGI disaster, which is, it didn't click to me that it means, so the asteroid hits at the very end here. That means that there's no asteroid for everything that comes before it, which struck me as strange when I was watching the movie. It's like, oh, wow, this movie is almost entirely not the part that people remember about it.
Yeah, it's not the Deep Impact.
Even in Armageddon, I think the first scene is just pieces of rock flying into Earth and destroying things, because, of course, that's how it would begin. In the what did experts have to say about this movie, they agree. It seems like the understanding is that, from what I read very briefly, from a very layperson point of view, is from looking over some of these discussions from astronomers, is that Armageddon, is that Deep Impact kind of, again, wins by default because it tried, where Armageddon did not. Unsurprisingly, the positing that the movie makes, even I kind of couldn't quite buy it, that they blow up the second comet or part of the comet right before it hits Earth into a bunch of little tiny pieces that they then say will burn harmlessly in the atmosphere. From what I read, that the experts do not think that they would burn harmlessly in the atmosphere.
It'd be like millions of bullets coming down and just killing all of us.
They would burn quite harmfully. they would not burn up. They would be not nuts.
Well, there you have it. We'd all be screwed no matter what.
Yeah.
All right. Our last film this month is a gloriously campy marriage between a disaster movie and a creature feature, directed by Rennie Harlan and released on July 28th, 1999. This is Deep Blue Sea.
What we're attempting has never been done.
She's sleeping like a baby.
You've seen sharks before.
These three are the death sharks.
Wow. But on July 30th...
As a side effect, the sharks got smarter.
you'll meet a whole new breed.
It can do that? Bust through a steel door?
She screwed with the sharks, and now the sharks are screwing with us.
Deep Blue Sea, rated R, starts Friday, July 30th.
Searching for a cure to Alzheimer's disease, a group of scientists on an isolated research facility become the prey as a trio of intelligent sharks fight back. Smart sharks.
Yeah, that's what we're dealing with in this movie. Sharks. They're swimming backwards, yeah. Ken. Ken.
I know.
Sharks can't swim backwards. They're swimming backwards. We know that something's up.
Mm-hmm. So, what do you think of Deep Blue Sea?
I love Deep Blue Sea. I think it is the most ridiculous movie. And every time I watch it, I have a blast with it. It's just, it's so gloriously campy to me. I said that in the intro thing. But I like Deep Blue Sea a lot. I wouldn't say I love it. That's very strong. That's too strong.
Yeah.
That's too strong. But I do like Deep Blue Sea quite a bit just because of it. This is a movie that it definitely doesn't take itself seriously. You know, where Twister has some jokes in it, keeps it fairly light for the most part. I think Deep Blue Sea is a movie that it knows exactly what it is. You know, you have a lot of really great scenes. You have a lot of really great characters. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson in this is great. I mean, that he, you know, that's that one scene that I think everybody probably references when he gets killed. I think it was such a surprise. This is a movie I saw on pay-per-view also, actually. And I remember when I first saw that scene when he gets killed, right after he gives this big, you know, monologue and gets it. I just remember being, like, completely shocked by that and excited. So,
I watched this movie. I think I've seen it 3 times now. I watched this movie for the first time a few years ago because it was on Netflix, and I kind of felt like somewhere in the recesses of my mind, I kind of knew that scene, but I didn't know it enough to not still be surprised by it when it happened. And the scene was over, I thought, just how well this, not only that, well, this whole movie, but specifically that scene would just play to like a packed house on like a Friday night in a theater when it opened.
Oh man, I can only imagine. I mean, I didn't see this in the theater, but I can only imagine what it was like to be in the theater when that scene hits. Because I bet it was just insane.
It's a good scene.
It's such a fun movie. It's not a good movie, I don't think, by any stretch. But and I think that of the movies that we of the four, this has probably the. I mean, I guess it's just because it's an animal, like, and the focus is on the animal, whereas everything else, all the other movies were more like environmental things. But the CG in this movie is very bad, and but the animatronics, like the when they use a practical shark, that's really good. So, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag as far as the effects in this. However, there's a lot of really great, like, there's this giant storm, you know, and that's what kind of sparks this whole thing, and that all looks really good too. Like, the facility itself looks really good. You know, the whole conceit of this, where they think that sharks hold the key to curing Alzheimer's, like, that's a stretch. That in and of itself is a stretch. But then you have, like, this very elaborate underwater base, and the whole time I'm just like, why do you need an underwater base? Like, why can't you just have it on top of the water? Why is it so important that this base is under the water? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it just plays into that, and just in such a gloriously ridiculous way. In the exact same way it takes the jump from, we think that studying sharks could help us learn more about Alzheimer's disease, too. We made a bunch of sharks really smart.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, so in order to study the whatever makes sharks impervious to memory, I don't even know what it is. There's like two lines that
like one bewildering conversation.
Yeah, there's like they very quickly explain why they need to like make the sharks very smart in order to do this. And like, they're not, apparently they're not doing any kind of genetics testing, but then it turns out, of course they are. Which is also kind of an interesting dynamic in this. There's a couple things about this movie that I think go against what your expectations would be. I think the Samuel L. Jackson thing, where his death is a surprise and nobody saw that coming. I mean, I think that a lot of people would see, you know, the rich mastermind behind the project getting killed. Like, that's not, you know, that's predictable, but the way in which he dies is very sudden and unpredictable. LL Cool J in this as the cook, the fact that he makes it through the entire movie is something that I think also subverts expectations. And then you have the female lead, played by Saffron Burroughs. She's horrible. Like, she's not a good person in this. And I think that also kind of subverts expectations, because typically when you have a female lead, she's like the one that you like just naturally gravitate towards. She's the altruistic one. She's the one who's fighting for good. When she's the one who causes this whole thing, she's the one, like, she's the mad scientist, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I think that also kind of, you know, goes against what you would expect out of a creature feature like this.
It's a movie that gets close to giving its characters more nuance, but ultimately it just settles for making them different than what you expected them to be, or what like previous tropes of filmmaking would expect them to be.
Yeah.
One interesting thing that I think about a lot with this movie was that Saffron Burroughs' character was originally supposed to live, but the test audiences rapidly demanded that she be killed, so they had to reshoot the ending. It's just so weird to me that they demand and then they reshot the ending apparently very shortly before the film was released. Just briefly going through and reading on some of this movie, it was apparently shot mostly in the same facilities, like the water facilities that they used for Titanic. Building like great big tanks and everything. And it just reaffirms to me that making any movie sounds like a nightmare. Making a movie where it's set in water sounds unbearable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All the water in this looked so clean. Like, that was one thing I noticed. Like, if this were, like, a real situation, the water would be so murky and dirty. You wouldn't be able to see anything. It would just be, like, there'd be, like, debris everywhere. And it would just look nasty. But in this, a lot of the scenes are, like, the water's just bright blue. And clear. Not all the scenes, but a lot of them.
Yeah. There's questionable aspects to the water in this. But, you know, still a lot of water. Always the astonishing sight of a visual effect of, like, water flooding into a room like it does in that scene where they throw Stellan Skarsgård, through a window.
That scene's so crazy. When they poor Stellan Skarsgård, he's on a stretcher, he's got like an oxygen mask on, dude can't move, he's strapped in, and the shark's like tossing him at a giant glass window.
Yeah,
gets screwed in this.
If the Samuel L. Jackson scene is the scene that I've heard referenced the most, that might be the one that because it's the second most famous one about this movie. Just because once you see it, you never forget it.
Oh yeah, yeah. You have a pretty good supporting cast here. You have Michael Rapaport in here, who looks like a freaking teenager for some reason. Like, he looks so young in this to me. He's really good in this. You have Ada Turturro she's like sort of the lookout person, or the person who's manning the comms and all of that stuff, this also leads me to something else that I noticed. Like, they make a point to say, like, oh, this is a big facility. It's got tons of workers. I don't know, 50 workers, but they all leave on the weekends. They leave the base on the weekends. And it leads me to believe, like, okay, so it seems like they're doing, like, one of the biggest things, like, the whole reason for this facility being there is to test this stuff on sharks. And it's like, why are they doing that on the weekend? You know, why are they doing the big injection thing and, like, the brain scans and all that? Seems like something you'd want to do when, like, you're fully staffed. I don't know. I don't know. It's just a lot of strange things. There's also a scene where, so you have these, like, tunnels, these, like, cage tunnels that Thomas Jane, who he plays Carter Blake, he's the other survivor.
What a great movie character name.
Yeah, Carter Blake. He kind of, I guess this is a, he like feeds the sharks and whatever, and he goes through these like cage tunnel things. And there's this scene where they're like watching him do it, and the camera is tracking him. And it's like they're watching a monitor that has a camera tracking him. It's like the same shot that we're seeing as movie watchers. And that just drove me crazy. I'm like, how are they getting that angle? Where's that camera at? That's weird continuity things that bother me.
Yeah.
Still, I think that this is an extremely fun movie, though. I like the idea of hyper-intelligent sharks that decide to murder people. And that's the thing, like, they don't eat them. They don't eat them for food. Like, they actually go out to murder them.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that so bewilders me about that whole anecdote about the test audiences demanding that the Saffron Burroughs character die is because it would have to track and put together in the sense that you understood why any of these choices that she made in the first place. But because I'm still stuck apparently behind everybody by about 45 minutes or so, wondering, so why are they doing this with the sharks again?
Yeah, why does this exist again? Yeah, and they made two sequels to this as well. I didn't see either one. I did not see either one. And, you know, normally I watch sequels when it comes to the movies that we discuss. But in this case, I just couldn't bring myself to do it because I know that they're probably horrific. And
there are two direct-to-video sequels released within the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 2018 and 2020. Mm-hmm. So basically, just as a sign of just how much these sequels sort of fit in, I suppose, or I don't know, maybe it's not a sign of anything. Just I'm just endlessly amused by the idea that when I watched this movie for the first time 3.5 years ago, there was one deep movie in the Deep Blue Sea franchise that existed in available for viewing. Now, just under 4 years later, there are three.
Yep. And I definitely couldn't bring myself to watch them because they just look like Asylum or sci-fi movies. They're just, yeah, not into that. Is this the first Rennie Harlan? I think this is the first Rennie Harlan that we've talked about on the show.
I think so, yeah.
I'm sure that we'll come back to him. His output in the 90s was pretty good. He did The Long Kiss Goodnight before Deep Blue Sea, which I really loved The Long Kiss Goodnight when I was younger. So that's certainly on our list. He did Cutthroat Island too, which I also liked a lot when I was younger. Something tells me that one's not going to hold up. But he also did Cliffhanger, which I think is an action classic. And that was in 93. And he did The Adventures of Ford Fairlane with Andrew Dice Clay, which was... I don't think I saw that, actually. But it was very poorly received. And then he did Die Hard 2 in 1990. So he had a pretty good run in the 90s. I would say, and I'm sure that we'll be discussing some of his other titles. I don't really have much of an opinion about the dude's work as a whole. I think he's pretty, I mean, he's made a lot of bad movies. Like, I'll just put that out there. He's made a lot of
I was just thinking, What a 90s this man had, and we do have to go through them. I thought I had seen Cliffhanger, but I actually don't think I have. I did think I had for a second when you mentioned it, though, but I haven't.
Yeah, I love Cliffhanger. I really love Cliffhanger. Die Hard 2, I thought, was weaker than 1 and 3, but it's still decent. It's a shame he did Nightmare on Elm Street 4, but that came out in 88, so we wouldn't discuss it on this show. But I mean, yeah, like I feel like his biggest output was in the 90s, because after the 90s into the 2000s, you have like Mindhunters, which was bad, Exorcist the Beginning, which was bad. Like it kind of just went downhill from there. So yeah, I don't know.
I've also thought a lot about the existence of Cutthroat Island, just because it is one of those, you know, movies that kind of has a bit of infamy in the Hollywood history, because it's one of the movies where they attribute the end of an entire studio to it.
Yeah, I think it's probably gonna be. He also did Driven in 2001, which is also very bad. He was, I don't know if he still is, but he was married to Gina Davis. And I remember, like, because it was like one of those, because she was in Cutthroat Island, Long Kiss Goodnight, and it was like one of those deals where people were kind of talking about the two of them the same way that people talk about Mila Jovovich and Paul W.S. Anderson, where it's like, oh.
No, they actually weren't it doesn't seem like they were married that long, actually. They divorced by the end of the 90s.
Oh, there you go.
Mm. Yeah.
At any rate, I think Deep Blue Sea is definitely worth a look. I mean, looking at Rennie Harlan's filmography, I'd say it's probably one of my favorite movies of his. I think Long Kiss Goodnight is probably still number one, but yeah, it's a good time. It's, if you go into it knowing that it's going to be like just a cheesy, bloody good time, I think it'll be entertaining for you.
Absolutely.
All right, I think that's going to do it for this month. Thank you so much for listening. You can send us your topics and suggestions to 90s@filmpulse.com or by sending us a message on Facebook or Twitter at 90spod. Also, if you have a moment, please consider reviewing us on iTunes. That would be super helpful. For Ken Bakley, my name is Adam Patterson, and this has been Saved by the 90s.
Hi, everyone.